Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.
No other state has shown as many cracks in its system of counting COVID cases as Texas. Now the numbers are set to shift again. Details coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. Why is Texas having such trouble with coronavirus case counts? Edgar Walters of the Texas Tribune has the latest. A plan for affordable housing gets slammed as a tax windfall for developers. We'll hear why. An indigenous tribe pushing the University of Texas to hand over Native American remains. And the ultimate how-to book for those ready to leave it all behind, How to Astronaut. Those stories and a whole lot more when the national news show of Texas gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this Tuesday, the 15th of September, T-minus 49 days to Election Day. Inconsistencies and problems with COVID-19 data collection in Texas have clouded the picture of the pandemic's trajectory in the state to the point that some residents and officials say they cannot rely on the numbers to tell them what is really going on. So reported the New York Times over the weekend. Now hear this. The method for counting cases in Texas is changing again. So reports the Texas Tribune, where Edgar Walters covers Health and Human Services. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what is changing here? How will this new reporting system differ from the old one?
I think the easiest way to understand what's changed is that 6 months into the pandemic, the state finally has a way of tracking the date on which people were receiving their coronavirus tests rather than just the aggregate number of coronavirus tests that were being administered in Texas.
That hasn't been kept before?
It hasn't been kept in a standardized way that the state has been publishing. So the problem that the state was running into before was they were tracking this metric known as the positivity rate, which is the share of tests that come back positive, which can be a very useful number for epidemiologists when they're talking about the number of tests on any given day that are coming back positive. But the problem in Texas was we were not tracking actually when the tests were being administered, and we were seeing some of these huge delays between people getting a test and then when that test result was actually recorded and sent to the state. So the state would publish a positivity rate on, say, July 1st, but that would include sometimes tests that were administered as far back as March and April. So the data wasn't particularly useful at giving you the picture of the epidemic.
Well, no, wait a minute, because I think a lot of us know the story of how cases and deaths seem to peak over the summer in Texas and have been trending downward ever since. Does this new manner of reporting mean that we'll see all those numbers now spread out in a different way across a graph?
No, not exactly. We know based off of other metrics, not just tests, specifically hospitalizations, we have a good sense of how the pandemic has unfolded in Texas, which is, as you say, there was this really rapid growth, a lot of viral transmission earlier in the summer. Hospitalizations went up. Hospitals were packed in South Texas. We have now passed that peak and we're going down. But the positivity rate is an important metric that all kinds of public health officials have talked about and which the governor has kind of touted. It's useful as an indicator for public health officials to know just how bad viral spread is in a community. And so now we're finally getting to a place 6 months into the pandemic where we can have a better sense of what that number really is and can have a more reliable positivity rate metric going forward.
Over the weekend, the New York Times had a damning story about the numbers in Texas and how they have changed so much. In fact, no other state has experienced such problems with counting who's getting coronavirus where, when,
And why is Texas having such a basic problem with counting cases?
Well, I think there are a number of problems going on. The first is, frankly, Texas is a state where our investment in public health is just not very high compared to other states. Local health officials, the state, everybody has kind of admitted that, first of all, the technology infrastructure that they're working with is very outdated. You may have seen reports of local health departments collecting coronavirus test results by fax, for example. That's fairly common. So there are a lot of problems with sharing the data. You know, the state has to collect coronavirus tests from hundreds of labs and hospitals and nursing homes. They're not always speaking the same language. So you can imagine it's a fairly Herculean task. But frankly, the Texas level of manpower and technology infrastructure has just not been able to keep pace. The state says they're doing a better job now, but it's led to these problems where when the state comes back and revises its numbers, sometimes it leads critics to say, well, can we even be trusting these in the first place?
Well, now, is it clear whether this change is going to have any substantive impact on policies like opening portions of the economy or deciding whether to hold in-person classes in schools, that sort of thing?
It's not clear yet. I mean, it's certainly better to have more reliable data. And the positivity rate is something that the governor has talked about a lot. So it's good news that the state now has a positivity rate metric that accurately reflects a point in time. That said, you know, the governor has laid out metrics for reopening, if you remember earlier in the spring, that he said would be based off of numbers of tests, numbers of contact tracers. Those metrics weren't met when the governor moved ahead with his reopening plans. So it's hard to know exactly how this new metric factors into the, you know, official plan for reopening, you know, further, but we'll see.
Edgar Walters is Health and Human Services reporter for the Texas Tribune. We'll have a link to the latest on this story over at texasstandard.org. Edgar, thanks again.
Thank you.
In 2015, state lawmakers passed a last-minute tax break for nonprofit groups trying to increase the number of affordable housing units in Texas. But a new report out this week by the University of Texas Law School shows that private developers used it to earn a 100% property tax break. And those units, well, they're hardly affordable for what most consider to be low-income renters. Here to talk about the report and the tax incentive, Eric Dexheimer. He's a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Eric, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
First, take us back to 2015. What actually happened at the end of the legislative session?
So there was a bill that had been generated in the House. It was a very complicated bill. It had to do with these organizations called public facility corporations. They're nonprofits associated with the housing authorities. But it was described by its author as a cleanup bill. That is, it was essentially updating some statutes, and it moved over to the Senate. And in the closing days of the legislative session, Senator Craig Estes from Wichita Falls proposed this one-sentence amendment, which essentially gave affordable housing developers a 100% property tax break for building units in the, you know, in the one of the cities.
100% tax breaks. I don't recall hearing a lot of discussion about this, and it doesn't seem like there was a lot of discussion on the floor either, right? I mean, how unusual is that?
Well, these, you know, these things probably happen more than we'd like to think. As these sessions wrap up, there's been a lot of maneuvering by legislators to get their bills and their favorite projects into law. And so in the closing days of the session, this is what was called the floor amendment. It was discussed on the floor of the Senate. There was a single question. The question asked, would these tax breaks convey to nonprofits or to private developers? The lawmakers assembled there were assured that they tax breaks would be for nonprofits only, but it turned out to be not the case. It passed nearly unanimously. It went back to the House where it passed unanimously and was signed into law a few days later.
How big are these tax breaks?
So these are 100% property tax breaks. That means that the entire value of the land and the improvements on it are not taxed. And in addition to that, if you're building a new project, the construction materials don't have sales tax on them either.
But of course, one of the reasons cities are willing to engage in this in the first place is that they're getting affordable housing, right?
Well, that depends on how you define affordable.
In what way?
Well, most affordable housing in this country is built by private developers, and governments give tax breaks to incentivize them. But most advocates agree that the lower income you have, the greater the need for affordable housing to be built. These units are at the very top of what most people would consider affordable housing.
In fact, you talk about people with like incomes of $60,000 being able to be eligible for these units, right?
The way that some of these deals work, that's true, that if you're a single person earning $63,000, you would qualify as someone in need of affordable housing under some of these deals.
What about people earning a lot less than $60,000? Where are they going? Are they squeezed out of the market?
There is a great need for units for people earning what's called 60% of the average median income and below. These are for 80% and above. So the units that are being built under this law using this tax break are not for those people who are earning less than, you know, 80%.
Why is this happening? Is it because of a lack of oversight? Because the law seems pretty clear that you get the tax break if you're providing affordable housing. But the question seems to be, what is affordable housing and why aren't these units going to people who need it most?
They're providing housing for people who are kind of right on the edge of needing some government subsidized housing, you know, to help them afford a place to live in the cities they are. The second reason they do it is because they say it provides some economic development. That is, if you build a housing complex in an area that hadn't seen development before, that will kind of incentivize other companies to come. So it's kind of, they promote it as this mixture of sort of affordable housing, but also economic development.
Eric Dexheimer is an investigative reporter with the Houston Chronicle. We'll link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Eric, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
What are Texans talking about on this Tuesday? Let's find out. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor. Hello, Wells.
Hi, David. We're hearing from folks about the state's change to coronavirus reporting data, and as y'all alluded to with the reporting issues Texas has faced, some distrust out there. Via Twitter, James tweets us that, "I believe Abbott is playing politics with the numbers just as Trump. I have zero faith in the current leadership." Meanwhile, Michael Dorf poses an interesting question. He writes, "If it's still the case that we are not reporting rapid tests, then I don't trust it," alluding to the reporting that rapid tests at the freestanding clinics and such weren't being included in the state's official count. He notes that a member of my household tested positive via rapid test, and to my understanding, she is not counted. There must be thousands of unreported shadow cases. And on our Facebook page, Stuart Royal says, "The coronavirus response from the state has been a failure of our public officials to respond to this public health issue." Just a range of the comments we're seeing out there, David, and there's lots more coming up too, I bet you know. I'll be back with some more from social media later in the program.
By later, he means about 35 minutes or so. Wells Dunbar continues to monitor what Texans are talking about on social media, and he'd love to hear from you, too. Reach out at Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Coming up on 19 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, helping eligible Texans with disabilities save and plan for the future to pay for qualified disability expenses with a tax-advantaged ABLE account. Learn more at texasable.org.
Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The statewide shutdown order for bars has endangered more than a few longtime watering holes. Houston Public Media's Florian Martin visited some of the oldest bars in Houston to see how they've been faring and what their future looks like.
At West Alabama Ice House, owner Petros Markantonis was working to get his bar up and ready again, weeding grass and blowing out dust. The sign outside the popular outdoor bar in Montrose has said closed again since late June, when Governor Greg Abbott shut down all bars in the state after a surge in coronavirus infections.
On the Friday that Governor Abbott closed us for the second time, we had opened up at 10 a.m., and that was about the time that the governor made the announcement. And so we were one of the only bars open in town.
Though for just 2 hours until the order went into effect. Since then, the almost 100-year-old little building has sat empty.
I've been trying to keep the mortgage payment paid and keep the utilities paid. It's been a struggle. I'm a little behind.
Marcantonis is hoping to be able to open back up thanks to a loophole from the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission. It now allows bars to apply for a food certificate based on projected sales. As long as revenue from food exceeds 50%, they're allowed to open. That includes snacks and meals sold from a food truck.
We are projecting that the food truck will do 51% of our food sales and that our alcohol sales will be less than that.
Marcantonis is also hopeful that the governor will start reopening bars soon, regardless of food sales. Downtown, Carolyn Wengler has owned Warren's Inn and La Carafe for the past 34 years, attracting regulars and tourists alike.
We had people coming from the other countries even, and especially at the Carafe, we had more people over there from other countries because they would hear about the Carafe.
Wengler's bars have also been closed for most of the year, reopening only for about a month from May to June. She's relied on savings to get by.
I'm okay, and I can still survive for a little while longer before it gets to the point where it'll be critical.
Wengler is also banking on a food certificate, and she's working on beefing up her kitchen to get to 51% food sales. She says currently, Warren's only brings in about 5% from food.
Over here, I'll have hot wings and chicken tenders and onion rings, french fries, and I guess that's about it.
On the other side of Market Square at La Carafe, there'll be a food truck. Wengler says she just filed her application with the TABC and hopes to get the green light soon. Around the corner on Main Street, Natsuo, that spells Houston backwards, is a dark artsy bar slash live music venue. Owner Jim Pirtle says he shut down in March, even before any government mandate, and the bar stayed closed during the month-long reopening.
We wanted to hold back and observe and also look at other bars of how they were doing it and what would be a safe way to open a bar. And my conclusion is there's no safe way to open a bar.
Other than having customers be outside, Pirtle says. That's why he's supporting a plan to shut down Main Street so that downtown bars can extend their patios past the sidewalk.
As opposed to people going inside in the air conditioning and if someone's sick, throwing the virus up into the system and just recirculating it.
The downtown district is working to close a section of Main Street for bars and outdoor cafes this fall. Until then, Pirtle says he can get by financially because he owns the property and only has to worry about taxes and utilities. Others aren't that lucky.
I don't know if I'll ever come back.
Tom McLendon is the longtime owner of the Big Easy, a popular blues bar in Kirby Drive. He says most music venues are threatened.
The big venues will probably stay open. They have the backing, they can get the loans, but the small guys, we're disposable.
McLendon says he has enough savings to pay the rent and utilities for one more month, but he doesn't want to take on a loan when he isn't even sure if his bar has a future. I'm Florian Martin in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. As Texas school districts shift to virtual schools, some families left behind because of a lack of internet access are fed up with delays by public schools to fix the problems. In one zip code south of downtown Dallas, KERA's Bill Zeeble caught up with one parent choosing to leave the district behind in favor of homeschool.
Lenona Shield sits among the plants on the back patio behind Bonton Farms in South Dallas. This green retreat's located in one of the more notoriously neglected zip codes in Dallas. In 75215, the poverty rate's high, grocery stores are few, and technology is so spotty, it's been called an internet desert. When COVID-19 forced schools online last March, Shield says she and her three children felt it.
It was just devastating.
That's because Shields has no internet at home and says neither do a lot of her neighbors. Many of them don't have computers either.
And the people that did not have internet, didn't have laptops, they couldn't get their children's work turned in. I didn't actually receive my daughter's hotspot until the last day of school. For the parents that did not have hotspot on their phones, internet, don't have phones, they were without.
She got a hotspot on the last day of school. I got a hotspot the last week of school.
That's Shield's friend, Lakeisha Wallace. In response to the pandemic, some internet providers like Sprint, T-Mobile, and others offered free or low-cost Wi-Fi services for households like theirs. But neither of them heard about the offers. Wallace wishes she had.
My son is in a collegiate program. He's doing dual credit. He's getting college credit, so he missed out on a lot.
Wallace says she had to go to Skyline High School three different times for a laptop she should have had months before. She says a working computer didn't arrive until the pandemic did. That sounds painfully familiar to Lenona Shields.
My son, Adarion Shields, is at the James Madison Collegiate Program. He's supposed to already had a laptop at the beginning of school. We signed a contract. Didn't receive it until the pandemic.
Dallas ISD knew about some of these problems. Jack Kalanick, the district's chief technology officer, says laptops for Collegiate Academy students didn't work because the computers were incompatible with the Dallas College system. It took months to fix. With the March pandemic, Kalanick says the district got hotspots and computers as fast as it could, but that's when the whole world wanted them too.
We worked with suppliers that had, you know, supply to give. And in this case, AT&T worked very quickly to get that technology deployed to the district. It was too slow, and I do wish we would have been faster. I still wish we could move faster with respect to deploying our hotspots.
The district has since rolled out thousands more computers and hotspots at a cost exceeding $20 million. For Shields, that's too little, too late.
And this is how we're being treated. We're going to have to homeschool our kids again. A lot of parents are not equipped. They have kids. They're doing the best they can. It's hard.
Shields has now given up on the district and says she'll teach her kids at home this year. That means actually withdrawing them from Dallas ISD. She wants the district to feel the loss of the education money that follows each student.
I would rather do homeschool with my kids if I have to do something outside of the district. They won't be getting that money for my kids this year unless they do something better, and I don't see that coming right now. Until then, my kids are not coming back into the district.
Shields knows she has to find adequate online coursework for her kids who are in three different age groups. She's ready for the challenge. She also says her apartment complex has computers on site that will help finish her virtual classroom. I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Tarrazas. A woman detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement was given a deportation order Monday after reporting sexual abuse and assault by guards. The woman was held at the El Paso Processing Center. Her allegations and those of another woman and man prompted an investigation by the Department of Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General. As deadly wildfires continue to devastate the West Coast, more than 200 Texas firefighters are helping combat two of the blazes in California. Aaron O'Connor with the Texas A&M Forest Service says one they're battling is the August Complex Fire, which is now the largest in that state's history.
And then the other fire that the Texas resources are responding to is the Creek Fire on the Sierra National Forest in Clovis, California.
The Texas firefighters are scheduled to stay in California for at least 2 weeks. Texas is preparing to implement legislation that is restructuring how the federal government funds state child welfare systems. The Family First Prevention Services Act is focused on supporting prevention and higher quality foster care providers. The Texas Department of Family and Protective Services released its strategic plan for how to comply with the law this month, but advocates say there are still issues the state needs to work on. Stephanie Rubin heads the group Texans Care for Children. Rubin says she supports the agency's goal of reducing the number of foster children placed in group settings, but says Texas needs strategies to improve the quality of these facilities.
The risk of not doing that is we could lose more than $50 million over 2 years if we don't improve the quality of foster care facilities. So that's actually a huge important thing we learned from the strategic plan is the potential loss of federal money we need desperately.
Rubin adds the Texas legislature needs to make figuring out how to implement this law a top priority when they reconvene.
Hopefully this next session, our leadership with this new federal funding opportunity and the court pressure will really get the job done for kids.
Earlier this month, a federal judge ruled Texas was in contempt of court for failing to make changes she ordered to long-term foster care to ensure children are safe. The Dallas Stars are heading to the Stanley Cup final for the first time in 2 decades. They defeated the Vegas Golden Knights in Game 5 of the Western Conference Finals last night. Interim head coach Rick Bowness shared his excitement with the team after their win.
There it is, boys. 4 more to go.
The Dallas Stars will face either the Tampa Bay Lightning or the New York Islanders. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
As communities grapple with the coronavirus pandemic, new developments unfold continuously. Catch up on the day's news from around the world and across Texas by listening to All Things Considered, weekday afternoons on your local NPR station.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. More than 5,000 people in immigration detention centers have contracted COVID-19. At least 600 of those are active cases. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials have released some medically vulnerable detainees during the pandemic. Texas Public Radio's Ronaldo Leanos Jr. has the story of one woman who's struggling to get her sick husband out of an ICE facility in the Rio Grande Valley.
Gabriel, did you finish your assignments? Yeah, well, how many more assignments you have, buddy?
Jessica, who agreed to speak with me if I didn't use her full name, hasn't seen her husband, Hildur Lainez Alvarez, in months, and neither have her 5 children. Lainez Alvarez is being detained at the Port Isabel Detention Center. He was transferred there after being almost 3 months at the neighboring El Valle Detention Center, also in the Rio Grande Valley. Lainez Alvarez was apprehended at the border in May, trying to re-enter the U.S. after being sent back to his home country of Nicaragua.
When Border Patrol found him back in early May, they broke his hand, fractured his arm. They did a botched surgery, He's already had pus coming out of his hand due to the lack of medical treatment in the facility.
A few weeks ago, Jessica says she got a scary call from her husband.
He said, Jesse, he said, I want to tell you something. I have really bad news. I want you to be strong and keep, you know, doing the best you can. You're a good mom. Take care of my kids. But I have this virus. I have COVID-19.
Jessica, who lives in Florida, says she started crying. She says on top of COVID and the injuries he got when he was apprehended at the border, her husband also has asthma. She reached out to an immigrant rights group called Freedom for Immigrants. They filed a complaint with the Department of Homeland Security's Office for Civil Liberties and Civil Rights, asking them to investigate and ensure Lainez Alvarez receives immediate medical care. They also arranged for a doctor, Kate Sugarman, to evaluate his medical records.
It looks like he needs a corrective surgery to correct the surgery that they botched. But in order for somebody to properly heal from surgery, they need extremely clean conditions. They need a lot of rehab, physical, occupational therapy after the surgery. And none of this was provided to him after his first surgery. So we know that they are incapable of providing him with the conditions to heal properly. But in addition, under ICE custody, he is now COVID infected.
Sugarman sent her findings to the warden at the El Valle Detention Center and DHS to support the complaint filed by Freedom for Immigrants. Here's Cynthia Galas with Freedom for Immigrants.
ICE has discretion to release anyone under custody, pretty much. So there really is no reason why Hildur should be detained and receiving care outside. He has a particularly strong case because he has a strong community outside. He has a U.S. citizen wife. Doctors have been advocating for him. There really is no reason why ICE is detaining him.
Freedom for Immigrants is calling for Hildur's release because they say ICE has proven itself incapable to take care of him.
So unfortunately, Hildur's case is not an isolated incident, and I wouldn't say that medical neglect is rare in detention. It is particularly egregious that he was harmed by the government.
Again, Dr. Sugarman.
ICE has already had their chance to appropriately treat him, and they didn't. They botched his surgery. They've denied him post-op care.
Immigrant rights organizations also have criticized the transfers of detainees from one facility to another during the pandemic because they say this is one way COVID is spreading in ICE detention. ICE says it transfers detainees to prevent overcrowding or to move a detainee to a more appropriate facility based on circumstances and risk factors. Norma Herrera is with the RGV Equal Voice Network. She's been in contact with dozens of detainees at the Port Isabel Detention Center, where Lainez Alvarez is now detained as well.
So there are some folks who have been released because they have underlying like medical vulnerabilities to COVID. And then there are folks who have just been transferred to other places. And then there are many, many folks who have just been deported. When you sort of look at the big picture, it seems kind of arbitrary who gets to be released into the community, who gets transferred, and who gets deported.
Jessica says she's still waiting to hear back about whether or not her husband will be released. She says her kids often cry and ask when their dad is coming home.
His kids miss him. You know, hopefully, you know, we can go along with our dreams, like making a business together. And, you know, we had plans.
In addition to the support from Freedom for Immigrants, Jessica is also working with an attorney. Cynthia Galas says Jessica's husband has received some physical therapy, but it hasn't been consistent and she's still concerned about him because she says ICE has a history of medical neglect that has led some detainees to die. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Mission.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
I'm Miles Bloxon.
And I'm Elizabeth McQueen, and we are back with Season 5 of Pause Play.
Like we never left. This season is all about change. Changes in the laws, climate change, tech, and ticket prices. I mean, the list goes on, really.
Yeah, and we're going to look at how all these changes impact the Austin music scene. The new season starts on April 17th, but you can catch up on all the other seasons at KUTX.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. For those of you interested in space and space travel, a helpful new guide hits the shelves today. It's called How to Astronaut, an insider's guide to leaving planet Earth. This might be the year to do it, some folks say. I'm joined now by the book's author, Colonel Terry Virts. He is a Houston-based retired NASA astronaut. Terry, welcome to the Texas Standard.
It is great to be here.
You know, this is interesting, this approach you've taken, because there are quite a few books out there by astronauts who've returned to Earth talking about the mission, what they saw from out in space. But you approach this story so that you weren't retreading the same ground. This is sort of a view toward heading out into space, right?
Yeah, absolutely. My goal, I wanted to write something that hasn't been written, and there's a million astronaut memoirs, so this is not that. I wanted to make a fun book that's accessible to everybody, you know, young and old, men and women, anybody who's interested in space, I hope will enjoy it. And I had two goals when I wrote it, and that is for people to say wow and laugh. Those were kind of the two things. Doesn't require any technical expertise. It's a fun book about stuff you may expect and some stuff you might not expect.
Say wow and laugh. I guess in the parlance of mission control, mission accomplished here, because it is fun. but what's interesting is that in a way, the implication, how to astronaut, right, that even in the title, is that almost anyone can do this. And I can remember a time when, you know, kids were urged to bear down on math and science, and people were told about the rigors of physical training, that it wasn't for just anyone. You know, you either had the right stuff or you didn't. You seem to suggest that this is doable by anyone almost. I'm sure that's a stretch.
Well, I try and bring the experience to anyone. You know, you do need to be in good physical shape, or being weightless will just wreck your body if you're not. But the interesting difference, back in the day, the space shuttle missions had specialists. You know, I was a pilot and I did robotics. We had a couple guys who did spacewalks. You know, we would fly medical doctors. So everybody kind of had their role, just like on Star Trek. You know, you've got the red shirts and the yellow shirts, and the, everybody has a role. But on the space station, I had to do everything. I was the crew doctor and the crew scientist, and I was the TV personality doing interviews, and I would have to pilot the spaceship, and the accountant keeping track of all the equipment was coming up. So that was actually what I enjoyed about spaceflight probably more than anything, was the diversity. You know, it was not – my short attention span would not work well with only having one job to do. So the modern-day space station astronauts actually have to be jacks of all trades, because there's only a handful of people. There's not 100 people with different specialties.
What if there's any one thing that you need to bring with you to space, maybe something that's not in the handbook, what would you say it would be?
So if you're a rookie, I haven't necessarily thought of this. One thing I would bring would be some space sickness medicine to make you feel better. Because if you've never flown in space, if you're not used to that kind of thing, you're not going to feel good. So bring some medicine with you.
Something for the nausea, I guess.
Better living through chemistry, yes. And if you're one of these space tourists going up for a few minutes, take the medicine. You'll be happy. We used to have this plane. There's a chapter in my book called The Vomit Comet. I think it's the Vomit Comet, Your First Taste of Weightlessness, which is
lovely.
Kind of a play on words. Yeah. And it was awesome. I love flying on that thing, but I did it without taking medicine, and I did it with taking medicine. Uh-huh. And you are much happier taking the medicine. And it was funny. I was just before this interview, I did another interview with one of my Russian crewmates, Gennady Padalka, who spent more time in space than anybody, 879 days. And we were comparing the Russian Vomit Comet with the NASA Vomit Comet.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, very, very similar experience.
Want to roll back here because you have some chapters here that are very forward-looking. For instance, chapters on spaceflight to Mars and time travel. We're talking a realm of speculation to a certain degree. Why did you feel that was important to include in a book about how to astronaut?
Yeah, so I wanted to have the normal stuff like, how do you do emergencies in the space shuttle? How do you fly a jet? How do you become a crew medical officer? But some of the more often, I hadn't never thought about that, but that's an interesting topic, like time travel. So I'm talking about relativity. And when I was in space, I actually aged less than people on Earth because of the acceleration and also the velocity that I was flying at. I talk about how to get to Mars. I talk about, are there aliens? Some other unusual topics like, what do you do if your crewmate dies? What do you do with their body? That's something that I don't remember formally training on, but it's, you know, people don't last forever. And if we fly in space for a long time, then eventually that's going to happen. So anyway, some interesting topics that you don't normally hear about in a typical NASA interview.
What did you miss most when you were in space?
There's a couple chapters about different things you miss in space. But, you know, your friends and family, of course, that's the one thing that sure. You just can't have. I missed the food in space was actually really good. It was better than what I cooked for myself as a bachelor. But I remember when I landed, we took a couple hour helicopter ride to an airport, just a normal international airport. And there was a kiosk and my flight surgeon went over and bought me a chicken sandwich. And that thing tasted better than any food I've ever had in my life because it was bread. It was my first bread in 200 days. It was like mayonnaise. I just still remember that chicken sandwich. So food, you know, was good in space, but it's not Earth food.
Scariest moment. I'm thinking the scariest moment had to be liftoff.
Well, I'll tell you, my scariest moment was really easy. So before I launched, I was flying with an Italian lady named Samantha Cristoforetti, great friend, the most popular Italian on Earth. She's massive rock star in Italy, first Italian woman ever in space. And she said, hey, Terry, you're not allowed to go into space until you learn how to cut my hair. So I had to go to the hairdresser here in Clear Lake, Houston. And I spent 2.5 hours learning how to cut her hair. And then when we got in space, after a few months, she's like, hey, it's time to cut my hair. Most women just let their hair grow long and they put it in a ponytail and they don't worry about it. But Samantha needed the actual Italian haircut. So of all the stuff I did, launch on the shuttle, fly combat over Iraq, you know, do spacewalks, cutting Samantha's hair was by far the most stressful thing I've ever done in my life. I did not want to screw that up.
Boy, that's a different perspective. That's for sure.
It's true.
That is really interesting. So if you were preparing a young person for a career in space, what would you tell them?
A couple things. Do what you love. Everybody has gifts and talents, and so pursue that. And then you won't be going to work for your whole life. You'll be doing what you love, and that's really important. But the biggest lesson I learned through my career was don't tell yourself no. People would always tell me, oh, you're not going to get to be an astronaut. No one actually gets to do that. That's crazy. You know, that's astronaut, that's nice, but you should just be an accountant. And so if you tell yourself no, you're never going to get to do the dream. Look, if it's astronaut, but most people aren't going to be astronauts, but if your dream is to be a doctor or a lawyer or start a business or, you know, help people in Africa or raise the family you want to raise, whatever your dream is, you have to try for it. Otherwise, you're not going to get off the ground. And so that's my message. Don't tell yourself no.
Don't tell yourself no. If you are thinking about a mission to space, you might want to start right here. How to Astronaut, the author, is been our guest, Colonel Terry Virts. He is also the author of another book called View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World, a fascinating read unto itself. Colonel, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard, and congratulations on the new book.
Thanks for having me on. This was a lot of fun.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. For the past 4 years, members of the Maya Con Garza Band in San Marcos have been asking the University of Texas to repatriate 3 sets of Native American remains held by the school's Archaeological Research Laboratory. The tribe wants to rebury those remains. Rianne Roldan of KUT Austin reports.
More than 50 people circled around an altar right beneath a giant concrete sign welcoming people to UT Austin's J.J. Pickle Research Campus. Laid across 2 blankets are bouquets of flowers and bowls with traditional sacred medicines like Texas sage and cedar. At the altar's head are 3 cardboard boxes. They represent the 3 Native American remains that the Maya Con Garza Band are asking for. Maria Rocha is on the band's board of elders. She's also the executive director of the Indigenous Cultures Institute in San Marcos, which was founded almost 15 years ago by members of the Maya Con Garza Band.
Who has been in Texas where these culturally unidentifiable remains have been dug up? Who has been here for 14,000 years? The Kwahuiltecan people.
Kwahuiltecan is a collective name for the small autonomous bands of Native Americans who lived in Central and South Texas before the Spanish conquest.
So just logically, something was dug up here. We've been here 14,000 years. They're our ancestors.
The band says it's important to rebury the remains because the Maya Con Garza believe that when someone dies, only their physical body dies. What begins after is a spiritual journey.
And when the remains are disturbed, it disturbs the spiritual journey of the spirit. And the spirit is out there in limbo, in agony, in pain, suffering and all this stuff. So that's why we feel it's our obligation to repatriate, to rebury the physical remains of that individual.
That's Dr. Mario Garza. He's an elder of the band and married to Maria. Together they run the institute. Maria and Mario say they've been helping tribes all over Texas repatriate remains for decades.
It's our obligation to fight that fight. And even if we don't win, what will UT benefit from beating indigenous people out of their ancestors' remains?
Yeah, what do they have to gain?
UT has returned indigenous remains before. In 2007, the school reached an agreement with the Comanche Nation. But UT says it cannot legally prove that these remains are related to the Maya Con Garza Band. In a letter sent to Garza earlier this month, the university says, quote, The remains are culturally unidentifiable, and nothing ties them to the Miacan Garza Band other than your assertion that any remains in Central Texas are your ancestors. The band's elders understand this is an uphill battle. But back at the demonstration, many of those present felt like the fight was only just beginning, despite UT's denial. Jessica Sanchez Flores is co-chair of the Native American Graduate Student Association at UT. She called on those in attendance to send letters and make calls to interim president Jay Hartzell.
This is not a separation between indigenous or non-indigenous, but rather that we all come together because we are talking about ancestors, and this could be anyone's ancestors.
For Cheyenne Grubbs, it's a question of seeing Native American people as human and not just remains. She's on the board of UT's undergraduate Native American Student Association.
Hale Tosa Hoche Foyat Cheyenne. Hello, my name is Cheyenne. I belong to the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma through my grandmother. There's people hurting. There's people feeling a lot of emotions. There's answers to ease that pain, and it's just doing what's right.
The band hopes that with enough attention from UT students and the larger Central Texas community, that the school might change its mind. I'm Rhianne Roldan in Austin.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard.
We love hearing what's on your news radar, and Wells Dunbar monitors it constantly. He's our social media editor. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. You are correct. We do love hearing from our friends and listeners out there, and we're continuing to hear about the change in Texas coronavirus reporting data. As we noted earlier, there's some distrust out there, what with odd fluctuations in the state data up to this point. Really helpful comment here on our Facebook page from Rachel Elizabeth, drawing somewhat of a distinction. She writes, I trust the public health professionals and epidemiologists who are working hard to combat this virus and educate the public in extraordinary circumstances. She adds, I don't trust politicians to act on their advice or to be open and transparent about that COVID-19 data. So an interesting distinction that one of our listeners raises there, and really just points to the ongoing, you know, situation that we all find ourselves stuck in day after day, this ongoing pandemic, David.
You know, something that was raised was how information had been faxed to officials,
right,
you know, back and forth. And a lot of people think, faxes, what are they doing faxing? And there's a lot of inertia built into some of these institutions, mm-hmm, including healthcare. And I think a lot of healthcare professionals would acknowledge this, where, you know, you're trying to protect people's privacy, and these rules were baked into place,
right,
some time ago. And so this has been a real challenge, not just here in Texas, but extraordinarily so here in Texas, I think. And that's the point. There was, I mentioned, yeah, in our conversation, there was a really interesting story in the New York Times over the weekend worth checking out over how inconsistencies and problems with data collection have really made it tough for officials to figure out what the pandemic's trajectory actually has been in and how that's undermining public trust in government.
So yeah, and quickly, and I just point to a similar sort of dynamic playing out as we've seen here in Texas and in states across the nation with regards to the unemployment situation and the fact that we're reliant on these old systems that have been in place that really haven't been, you know, like kept up or expanded to meet the sort of current conditions that we find ourselves in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, another, you know, byproduct of the pandemic and the economic fallout that it has created, it has been the evictions across the country. And now we are in a nationwide halt on evictions. But an interesting headline here from the Houston Chronicle I'm seeing. It's Fort Bend Representative Gary Gates evicted over 100 tenants during the pandemic. Now, Gary Gates, that is a state representative from the Houston area, Fort Bend County, the southwest suburbs there of the Houston area. And he is also a landlord. And according to some reporting from the Houston Chronicle and the Hearst newspapers, evicted over 100 tenants since the pandemic began there. So they're taking pains to note that he has not evicted any other tenants since that halt order was issued by the CDC. But a pretty interesting headline there from Houston Chronicle nonetheless.
Yeah, I was taking a look over at statesman.com, the Austin American Statesman, and something that's been on the front pages, I think it's safe to say, here in the Texas capital city for some time, has been the governor's proposed takeover of Austin police.
Oh, yes.
There's a really, really interesting story that Philip Jankowski has written where he's examining the legality of this. The headline is experts, proposed state takeover of Austin police legal but unprecedented. And it's a very interesting write-up on the back and forth that's happening behind the scenes here, but more importantly, the legality of it, and definitely worth checking out. So one of many stories that we continue to track here at the Texas Standard, and we'd love to hear what stories are on your news radar anytime. Just look for us on your social media platform of choice. We're out of time, but the news continues over at texasstandard.org, and we'll be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard team, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.
You've been listening to the Texas Standard. Texas Standard and KUT Public Radio are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find a lot more great content and shows like the Texas Standard in the NPR Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.